Today's podcast is brought to you by Blue Canary. The bird has landed on beautiful Bainbridge Island, conveniently located at 499 Madison Avenue. ASE Master Technician Clint Ramsey brings over 15 years of experience, award-winning diagnostic skill, and a desire to reinvent the automotive repair experience. Schedule an appointment online at bluecanary.biz or call them today at 206-451-4220. I got something for your mind, body, and soul. I got something for your mind, body, and soul.
Bystander Podcast. Now here's your host with the most, Tiny Tim.
What's good, Podcastville? You found the Bystander Podcast. Hey, today I have Stephen Rowley with me today. He's the author of a new book called The Lost Coin, and I'm excited to talk to him today. I hope you can be a friend and tell a friend about the podcast and support us on Patreon. Stephen, how you doing?
I'm really good. Thanks for having me here.
Good. I've gotten into this book. I will tell you the honest truth. I haven't gotten through it, but I like what's going on. I've only had it for a week here. It's a memoir of your basically childhood, coming from an adopted situation and trying to find your birth parents later in life. How did you get started thinking about this? This is a book that you wanted to write. I know that you took a step into this journey, but how did it become a passion that you wanted to write about?
Well, that's a good question. Just way back, I always knew I was adopted, and I certainly didn't think for many years I'd be writing a book about it. Nor for up until I was about 13 did I even have the impetus to go find, have some curiosity, burning curiosity to find my birth parents. But more immediately, I think the book was in me, to tell you the truth, but 2 years ago, I got notification through 23andMe that from a relative who was identified as a first cousin, which meant a big deal to me that I was actually really related to him, and got in touch with me. Turned out was not a cousin, but it turned out this person's mother was one of my, what I soon learned was one of my half-sisters, and through a flurry of emails within a half hour, discovered that the name of my birth father, I knew a little about him, and I shared that with the family, and that was all they needed, because I knew exactly, I self-identified as definitely his biological son. So with that, I inherited four new half-sisters and a huge family on their side. We're all roughly the same age. And right after that, we began exchanging photographs and family stories. But I'd say within a couple of days, I just sat down and started to write. I had already found my birth mother many years ago when I was age 40. And now here was the other end, the other bookend, discovering without any effort, seemingly any effort on my part, discovering my birth father. So having now known both of them, discovered them by very different means, it just seemed this was the time to write. Now I've been writing, I have an academic background and I've written a little about adoption, but I sat down and wrote 6 days a week, 6 or 7 hours a day for 5 months, and I came up with the first draft on Labor Day in 2022, which led me to an agent and an editor and all that stuff. So, but that it just kind of came out. Of course, it required a lot of editing, but the story was in there. And it would seem because of my background, both in education, but also as a psychotherapist here on Bainbridge Island, that I was bringing something else new to the story that was more compelling to me. It wasn't just the outer story of my search, was kind of a detective story, which is interesting in itself. What I was discovering by writing and what I already knew was the kind of exploration of the inner life of me as an adoptee, but also I think what are some universals that about the primal wound that happens to infants when they're separated from mothers at an early age. And so that telling that story became even more compelling to me.
Tell me a little bit more about that primal wound, because you were adopted at a very young age, six right. months, correct? Mm-hmm. And you were adopted into a loving family and had a sense of security, and your parents, adoptive parents, treated you well, correct?
Very well.
So what was burning inside you that made you feel like it wasn't a complete, you know, life?
Well, I suppose, you can put words to it. It's none of them seem adequate, although I try to do the best I can in the book. There, I think this is true for so many other adoptees. Sometimes it's unconscious. A lot of times it's conscious. There's a nagging feeling of something being not quite complete. There's something missing. Even with loving and supportive parents like mine, you kind of go, well, what's wrong? You got a great life, supported in education, you know, affluent upbringing and so forth. So what do I have to gripe about? So, but over time, it just seemed that's something, that completion of knowledge, also the visceral connection to, presumably at that time, an unknown, birth mother just seemed, on an emotional level, just compelling. Now, that wasn't like a steady state. It got up and down over the years. In the early years, which in my book recounts in the 50s and 60s and into the 70s, these are pre-internet days. So there was no Google. There was no 23andMe. There was no Ancestry.com. So a lot of that, I'll call it yearning, had to just simply sit there because I had to wait basically to go to college so I could have my own mailing address. There's a really pivotal part of the book that talks about where I talk about my mother when I was age 13 and raised the question of wanting to know more. She flew into a major fit and said, "What's the matter? Don't you think we love you enough?" I was so shamed by that and so angered by that I swore to myself I'd never talk to her about it again. And I never did, much to my chagrin as I got older, but I didn't. So, but that was the kind of lit the fuse. It was sort of like, I will find, it'll take me a long time, but I will find my birth mother just for the sheer completing some of that, the incomplete connection.
What do you mean by waiting for college to get your own mailing list?
I wasn't going to be writing to my adoption agency or to the state of Missouri coming back through the mail and going to, what's this? And, you know, frankly, when I was still in high school, I had other things to do. And as I got to college, I had a little bit more wherewithal. There were some measures of being able to locate adoption agency that I came from, and some of the other, I could had a more adult approach to finding out addresses of, you know, state county offices back in Missouri. So
how old are you now?
How old am I?
Yeah.
I'm older than you are.
I'm 57.
I'm 74.
Okay. So this has been brewing inside you for a long, long, long time.
Well, since we're on this, on my age thing, my birthday is February 10th. So February 10th, 2024, I'll be 75. On that day, along with a new colleague I have, we'll be speaking at the Kansas City Library, just a mile or two away from the original site of the Willows Maternity Sanitarium. So I'm doing it, admittedly, for nostalgic reasons. There's another writers' conference we're speaking at the day before. But it's that kind of, it's not just me, but of all the people, say in the Willows has a huge community on Facebook, there are a lot of us out there. And even from one particular institution, the Willows Maternity Sanitarium, which was the hub of the adoption, Kansas City itself was the hub of the adoption world for several decades because of the train stations and other means of transportation. So, but this was the penultimate. This was sort of the Ritz of the bunch, even though my birth mother did not come from a wealthy family by any means. But I think that hearing those, getting to know some of those folks and having those conversations reinforces time and again, we all had something similar happen that brought us, you know, we were all given up for better or worse. And let's say in many cases for the better, excuse me, but still there is the, we all carry that primal wound that I'm calling that. There's a lot of other people from an academic point of view have written about this. So it's not, I didn't invent the term, but it's something just by that very fact. It's a form of trauma, it's a separation. Now we can't access that in our minds as adults looking back to when we were, you know, 2 weeks old. Mm-hmm. Still, there is, it is a form of trauma. It's a developmental form of trauma. And my contention is that it stays with us in one form or another. Now it may radically alter our behavior as adults. It may not, but it's still something we carry. And the more people, as I've had these discussions through the book, bring these issues up, it's from a psychotherapeutic point of view, from a Jungian point of view or a depth psychology point of view, people, the lights blink on and go, oh, now I get it. Now I have this feeling. There's a great book by Danny Shapiro, who is a writer who wrote her book Inheritance a couple of years ago. Now, she grew up Jewish, although she had blue eyes and blonde hair. Everybody kept telling you're not Jewish like your parents. They were Ashkenazi Jews and back East. And she just discounted them. And then it wasn't until she was in her early 50s, which was maybe 6 years ago now, that her mother finally blabbed that her father, who she adored, who was no longer alive, wasn't really her birth father. It was a sperm donor. And her husband and she were able to locate and identify him within like less than 2 days. So, but up to that and through her writing talks about that same something. Something wasn't right. There was something missing. Something she couldn't put her hand on, yet she describes it beautifully. So I think that's not an uncommon psychological emotional state that a lot of people have. Believe me, not everybody who's been adopted feels that way. But on the other hand, in when we're talking about the unconscious, that it's by definition sometimes we can't be aware of. But when we look at behavior patterns in adults who have had other forms of trauma as well, including this kind of separation, unstable relationships, move around a lot, can't hold jobs, don't feel, you know, secure in relationships. I've said that, you know, if our adoption community had a theme song, it would be Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. Mm-hmm. How does it feel to be a complete unknown, like a rolling stone, no direction home? It's that kind of...
I'm going to throw that chair out after this interview. It's driving me nuts.
Well, don't have me with it. So anyway, so that's that kind of quality. And I go into the book and talk about, from without getting too jargony and psychological.
I also don't want to give away the book. People need to read this book.
Okay. But this I call it the inner orphan. This something that's searching. Searching for a home, searching for connection. And you could say literally, I mean, I've been married for, we just passed our 33rd anniversary and I've came from a stable home, but still there's that something else that, now I'm much more down the road as the book gets into later. I've sort of moved through some of that, but it's something I think most adoptees identify with in terms of their inner lives. Our outer lives are completely different, but our inner lives, much more in common.
Okay, I have a rescue dog, Romeo, that was taken away from his pack by a hurricane, and he was feral for the first 6 weeks and did not nurse, and he has fear anxiety. I was wondering if there's any correlation of the separation being that an adoptee may not have breastfed, and they don't have a connectivity with their mom, but it sounds like you were adopted a little bit further down the road.
The breastfeeding is maybe, by its own definition of primal wound, there's something more, in my mind anyway, something deeper in the psyche that goes beyond, because I probably was, other people who were not breastfed can turn out with entirely different kind of psycho-emotional lives, but again, I want to be clear that the type of trauma I'm talking about is aligned with or similar to other kinds of early childhood trauma that children can, you know, can be sexual, can be physical, can be emotional, can be neglect. Those are all forms of trauma that hit, particularly when you're that young. even before memory.
And that's all subconscious.
Yeah, until you begin to identify and work on, you know, bringing the unconscious to consciousness, which is partly what therapy does. Therapy isn't the only way to do that. You get it by meeting people, reading the stories of other adoptees and going, oh yeah, I can see that.
So. Yeah, you call this book a memoir of adoption and destiny. I feel like it's more about identity. Would that be fair?
It's both. The through line, so to speak, is I wanted to ask one question from my earliest days: who am I? So that who am I kind of echoes through the different chapters of my life. Not all of them about my adoption, but the adoption story, so to speak. That storyline, of course, it revolves itself, spools itself through my life story anyway. So. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Let's talk about a little bit about your identity. And you had a piece in the book about traveling to Chicago with your grandfather mm-hmm. and your father selling your house to a black man. And that was uncommon in your rural white area of where you grew up. Talk a little bit about how you saw identity once you got out of cornfields.
You've conflated two things, by the way, just clarify. The first part about my grandfather was on a cattle truck to the Chicago stockyards when I was little. I was probably 7 years old. So it was an eye-opener, seeing thousands of cattle and hogs, you know, being led to slaughter, riding the L in Chicago in the, would have been late, you know, the mid-50s, seeing poverty and black tenements that I'd never seen before, and also seeing Ernie Banks for the first time at Wrigley Field. So I would label those as at a young age being exposed to these things. And the echo being when a little bit later, when my family lived in Iowa City, my dad was completing his surgical residency there. It was a big deal to sell a house to an African American man, a black man. So he asked around the neighbors to make sure that was okay. It stuck out of my mind as like, that's still the times we were in. So this around race, around poverty, around class, social class, when we moved back to my hometown in Burlington, we had a nice big house across the street from a country club. Not every kid was living across from a country club. So that's kind of, it's both identity or who am I, but also the kind of like consciousness raising around those critical issues, I think at a really young age compared to what happened for many people much later in life. So I was blessed in that way to have that be exposed in those ways that I think put me on a different trajectory that was different than many of the people I grew up with.
Gotcha. So you didn't spend much time with people of color as you grew up in?
Well, in Burlington, Iowa, there were black people and portions of the community were black, but sports, of course, was the great integrator. I mean, we played, you know, side by side with black kids and so forth, classmates. But outside of that, as I point out in the book, we didn't socialize. It was not even on our radar screen. It wasn't a matter of like even thinking that. Well, these guys are our friends. Like, we treat them the same. Of course, that's all BS. But it was, I think, probably took going to college to get to live through the radical 60s and 70s, to both in terms of some of the strikes and school shutdowns that happened at University of Wisconsin. Some of those were over the Black Student Union, a way more diverse student body that was there than I grew up around. So, it was pretty much of a, had I not began to have some other level of consciousness, I could have fallen right into the kind of the Odyssey and Harriet world and never questioned, never understood much more than what was going on around me. That also includes, as I mentioned in the book, the any acknowledgement about people who then were called homosexuals, we call, you know, gay, lesbian communities there that existed. But it took me years to hear from other friends who knew what was happening in town and kind of the darker regions of the social world there. That was not an altogether pleasant experience for some who had to live secreted and closeted lives. But that was around me too. So, you know, this kind of unfolding of consciousness, which is a really interesting topic to me, how it happens. I mean, this is where destiny, I think, comes in to bring your word back. It's as though these things were fated. you know, the life I've had. I mean, here I am, you know, ultimately going to Stanford and having a, you know, a career in education, landing here as superintendent in Bainbridge Island for a while. I mean, it was a lot of hard work, but it was also a lot of luck involved in that. And you're kind of thinking, when I finally did, it was on the way to meeting my birth mother, which would have been around 1988 when I was just about 40. I got a letter from one of my new half-sisters telling me what her life had been like. Now, she's only 11 months younger than I am. And her letter is heart-wrenching. I don't know if you got that far in the book, but her description of her life and her sisters and her brother, a different father, you kind of go, well, that's the fate I missed. I mean, I missed, you know, and my birth mother ended up having a severe problems with drug and alcohol abuse. And when I did meet her back in a urban area back east, was living in a, had just come out of a halfway house, living in government sponsored housing. You look at that and kind of go, here I am, like fresh out of Stanford, Mr. PhD. And although our reunion was anything but into that, but it was still that recognition like, wow, it could have.
Tell the people a little bit about that experience, how when you guys finally did meet.
Well, she knew in advance it was coming. I had written a letter to her, which I've saved, as you can see in the book. I saved almost all the correspondence and paperwork I had all over these years. So one of my half-sisters and I, she drove me to where my birth mother was living. I call her Patty in the book. Do I call her Patty? I can't remember which name I gave her. Gloria. Gloria Jean Johnson. Jean.
Yeah, you made up names to protect.
I have to be careful. So anyway, she knocks at the door, and the door opens a crack, and I can see a figure, really short. And she said, you know, Mom, Steve's here. He's all the way from California. And the first word she said to me was, who the hell gave you the right to look me up? I didn't ask you to come here. So that was a little bit of a, you know, big gulp time. They're like, oh, take a deep breath. So I did. And I had brought flowers, some actually quite rare long stem white roses in a beautiful long white box, and handed it to her and said, I just want to know, first of all, that I didn't just sort of arrive. It took me some time to find you. And by the way, these flowers are for you. And it was a pause. Then she glanced at me and said, no one's ever given me flowers. Now, you know, even today, it's heart-wrenching to hear that and to what that meant. I mean, a simple gesture as flowers. I mean, and she had never received that. So we make our way into the kitchen, which is pretty barren and clean, but she obviously felt unlived in. She'd been there a couple weeks, and she had a roommate who was battling schizophrenia who wasn't there that afternoon. And she waved to the other room and apologized for not having her books there. And I said, you know, so, well, how many books do you have? She said, well, I have more than 500. At least they're all in boxes someplace. And then light bulbs started to go off in my head. It's like, because I'm, you know, I've had a strong background in academia, lots of books in my life and so forth. And as I'm taking that in and I'm looking around the walls of the kitchen, and I noticed a poster over on the wall, and I said something about, oh, I see you've been to the National Gallery. And she looks over her shoulder and points to the post. She says, well, that's a Kandinsky, of course. And then she launches into this recitation on exactly what period of Kandinsky's artistic life that came from. And it was a little miniature lecture on European art history. It just was mind-boggling, because weeks before that, I knew she'd been wandering the streets, you know, eventually picked up with, you know, booze bottles and pills and so forth. So anyway, I'll cut to the main thing, which I think is almost the heart of the whole book. I told a Ronald Reagan joke. He was running for president, and I could tell she didn't like him, and nor did I. But when I told the joke, she erupted in this spectacular burst of just humor and energy, just almost a howl. And it was so infectious that at that moment, it was like a Spock mind melt. She opened up to me. I could feel her. I could feel myself in her. I think she could feel herself in me. Her sense of humor was like mine. She thought the same way as she did. We had some of the same biases that each of us held. And at that moment, it was like, I'm home. I mean, still hard to talk about without getting just as emotional as it was the day that it had it. So, and then I went on and I asked her the one question I really wanted the answer to, which I didn't need to ask because I knew the answer, but, that was, do you remember me on my birthday? And that was, of course. So that answered the question like, no, I never left you. I mean, in my mind and heart, and nor had I. So that's what made that reunion so unbelievably special and moving, you know. It's like the old, Walt Whitman quote, after the rest of the day, we were together, I forgot the rest. I just kind of like, so I saw her the following day after I went out to another area to meet my other half sister, came back and we spent a couple hours and she had introduced me to her friend as her son and told me, or that my sister told my half sister said, you know, we always knew about you. We always had a chair at the table and no one said, and we knew that was you. You'd come back.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but after that,
did you broach the subject of why you were given up for adoption and the others were not?
Well, the other kids, it's a good question. I didn't have the presence of mind.
I felt uneasy asking it.
No, it's okay. Well, I think she had by then, the other three kids she had were with, she was married by then. Hmm. So they were going to keep those kids. this is where I put in the book that I had notes and I've lost them over years. I can't believe this is the part I'd lose. But she said, oh, you probably want to know about your birth father. I don't remember much about him in any way. And then I recall that at least for the next hour, that's all she did was talk about him. So, but that's faded soon after in my memory, but it didn't seem to matter because I think in the big picture, finding her always seemed more important than finding him. So, and maybe that's just natural being a mother and whatever, but I dare say that, her emotional bond with me then, and we recognized when I left, it's like we're holding each other in each other's arms saying the last time this happened was I was 10 days old, and the sacrifice on her side that she endured by giving me up mm-hmm. and going back to her small town. She was a nurse, but, I know for a fact from other sources that life was tragic for her after that process, and the kids didn't have her other kids didn't have the same relationship. Her life went off the rails for a long time, and she died a couple of years after I met her. I never saw her again.
You just saw her those 2 days?
Yep.
And did you ever get in touch with your birth father or find out who it is?
No, when we began, I wasn't until 2 years ago that I discovered who he was through my half sisters, and he'd been deceased since 1985. There was a little hint, and I'm still weighing. I'm trying to weigh in and appreciate what it's like to be on their side. Suddenly, this guy out of nowhere, mm-hmm. regardless,
it's got to be difficult for both sides.
Kind of like, you know, hey, we're related. You know, we share our birth father, and I think one of my half sisters, who's just really close to my age, said, well, she said, I got a laugh out after I read the book. She said, it's clear you didn't get your brains from our dad. You did get it. You did get your athletic ability. He had lettered in four sports at Indiana University back in the day. But I had a feeling that she said, yeah, you would have butted heads. You wouldn't have got along at all. So I don't know where I think there was also very likely another kind of quote love child in his life that was also a form of embarrassment. So I don't know whether his wife knew about me, their mother. I don't know. My guess is that, but at the time that I was conceived, he already had at least one child and might've had another one. You know, it was close to being born or had been born. So that clearly is a sensitive subject. Although when you look at the pictures of all of us, we look pretty much alike. And when mm-hmm. I look at their children, and I've seen pictures of all of their children, you know, I kind of go, wow, there's a lot of, I can see myself
in
the way they look. Yeah.
Yeah.
But other than that, our lives in terms of my professional life, my own interests and so forth, we're really pretty different in that way. So.
And, you know, I think life repeats itself sometimes. I know kids of divorce often get married and get divorced as well. You were adopted and then you turned to become adoptor.
My wife and I adopted our son, yeah.
Yeah.
When he was 4 years old.
And you weren't really planning on that, correct?
It was the first thing from my mind. We'd been, both were in education. My wife had been a teacher for years and still had a major 40-year career as a teacher and teacher trainer. And I had gone through the ranks and had been a teacher, principal, school district superintendent, college professor, and all that stuff. But we were like, hey, we love kids. We love them at the office. We gave it the office. When we're home, we have our own time. And we had no way we were going to have a kid until our son showed up. Another story about how he showed up. And once we saw him, it was all over. It was all over. I mean, I think he saw it too. We just absolutely fell in love. We said, it's still true, except for you. We want you. We want you. Are our son, almost from the get-go. And we were completely right in that. And then we had a couple months of a fight to get the legal pieces in place so we could do that.
Nice. Are you still actively working as a therapist?
Yep, I am.
And do you work with people that have been adopted?
Ironically, no, I haven't. I've had correspondence with other people and other therapists about the issue, but no, I don't. On my website, I talk about adoption a bit. Of course, there's the whole page about my memoir itself, but it's just next to that. My specialty in as a Jungian depth psychotherapist is that I specialize in working with trauma, so that part is really familiar territory for me. So yes, and so most people, not all. I mean, some people come with some pretty straightforward propositions on a problem they want to help get solved, and I help them with that. But for others who are plagued by deeper forms of anxiety, depression, big life, transitions through divorce, illness, loss of job, or I'll sometimes call an existential crisis, like who am I at age 50? Or my kids are grown up and I'm almost ready to retire. What am I going to do now? Who am I now?
Yeah, what's my third chapter?
Yeah, that's what I do. That's the sweet spot for me. And it's infinitely interesting. But it's informed by understanding the nature of psyche. I can do cognitive behavioral therapy and find myself doing it from time to time, but it's much more recognition that so much of what is, underneath those things like depression and anxiety are oftentimes other forms of anxiety or other forms of trauma of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people have experienced stuff don't identify it as such.
Yeah.
I thought everybody's old man, used to hit him. Gee, me? that kind of thing. So
they don't. If you're getting hit, it's not normal.
No, it's not normal, regrettably, we know how many children under 10 years old have been traumatized by beatings, and sometimes what I referred to before, developmental trauma, different than blunt force, physical trauma or emotional trauma. And this has to do with the way in which children bond or don't bond adequately when they're quite young. And so if the infant and its kind of a conscious awareness to the degree it has any senses that we're not, if I get a dirty diaper or I get hungry and I start to cry, I'm not sure mom's coming around at all. Mm. Maybe she will and maybe she won't. But every time it's a new proposition. So that forms a kind of a lifelong kind of pattern of insecurity. Now there's other forms. And of course, the worst form actually is neglect, where children are just abject, completely neglected. But that stunts normal development and or it also leaves this imprint of trauma on the psyche.
Yeah. Early childhood's everything.
Mm-hmm.
Really is.
So that, I'm using this metaphorically, of course, and I talk about this in the book, that what we call a kind of a splintering. So for example, I mean, this is really common. Kids are 7, 8, 9 years old, even younger, and parents go through a divorce and the parents think they've got it worked out and they split their time with their kid. But that often is such a telling form of trauma that stays in the kid and creates a kind of a sense of uncertainty about other people and a sense of loss that they can't quite put their finger on, or certainly up until they're adults have a way of grieving the fact that your parents left you.
Do you see that trauma in kids of divorce parents?
Yeah. I see it in kids and adults. It's really easy going back through case histories and kind of you know, it's one of those questions I have, you know, did you go through a divorce and so forth? So now there's a whole, I don't know we want to go there, but I'll just mention that also these kinds of early childhood traumas, and including sometimes concussions and head injuries, can create a form of brain dysregulation that is underscoring or the cause, root cause of emotional dysfunction. So dysfunction. So there's other treatments and remedies for that, but it's a, that's why early childhood is complicated. And also when we do see kids and parents who are so wonderfully bonded and who they're, where love is unconditional and where kids are read to and listened to and cared for physically and made to feel safe, it seems so normal and what we'd like to think, but of course it doesn't happen that way for a lot of people. So you can go to any teacher from any place would tell you, you can spot them in a classroom right away. The ones that are squirrely, mm-hmm. not attentive, not able to obey authority, figures of authority like a teacher, doing poorly in school, highly distracted, the so-called ADHD. There is some other kind, usually some other kind of traumatic history. I had a thesis at when I went to Pacifica Graduate Institute that I didn't write, but I was when I supervised principals in various other school districts here in the Seattle area. We look at the kids who are getting D's and F's in their freshman year in high school, which if you get two of those, you're not going to graduate. I mean, it's just, unless you kill yourself and go to summer school. So you're already creating dropouts by those D's and F's. But when I go through with principals and say, tell me who these kids are, there's all kinds of stories about family life, drugs and alcohol, fights, gangs. I mean, it's like, it's not their intellectual ability to learn algebra. It's about all the other learning obstacles and psycho-emotional obstacles that create failure. Yeah. So that's why these antecedents and early childhood experiences are so telling. Now they're not immutable. They're not like you can't overcome them. And a lot of famous people that we know have overcome them quite well, but not everybody does. And even for those who have managed to succeed on some levels, you think of how many entertainers you heard can never get over the fact that they grew up poor. I grew up in the poor in Brooklyn. Everybody was poor. We lived all six of the family lived in, two bedrooms and or one bedroom and so forth. Some people just cannot forget for all the understandable reasons. And so that really does alter our life trajectory. It is, in a sense, going back to the part of what becomes destiny. It doesn't mean absolutely you're fated to have things happen, but you can get that sense through my book, I think, and you hear the life stories, I've heard so many, as though you had an invisible hand behind you guiding you through life. And sometimes those directions are not always in happy places, but other people who manage to survive and do well, sometimes it's unexplainable.
Once you're an adult and you recognize the traumas that are hindering you going forward, how do you break that cycle if you know what's wrong and where it stems from, but yet you still have that behavior?
Well, sometimes I'm going to try to make what's a really great question and one that deserves probably a book to be written in response to it. But sometimes what happens is unresolved grief. And it's hard to say, well, I was 5 years old. How could I have grief? But sometimes we kind of, as though we can go back in time and mourn the loss of a divorce, mourn the loss of an inattentive parent, mourn the loss of a parent that may have died. We think we may have gone through something we call grief, but oftentimes we don't. And so that we begin, or we have an overbearing parent, for example, who's an authoritarian who demands certain kinds of behavior out of you no matter what, and is quite removed from you emotionally. And set absurd expectations and are punishing for not setting those expectations. Those become the ghosts. Those become, even for people whose abusive parent is dead for 10 years or longer, still are trying to act to make dad happy. You know, like, well, I wasn't such a good football player, but I'm doing what I can today in the men's basketball league. I'll show my dad I can be a good athlete or a good golfer or whatever, trying to prove mom I'm as good a mother as anybody. You have those ghosts from the past that are as though they have written the script for you that you're following without even knowing it. So some of the work is actually how do you uncover that consciously to realize, oh, yeah. And there's other techniques, of course, I won't go into now about how one begins to delve into that. sometimes people also get hung up on not being able to resolve who those parents were. For example, somebody may say in a therapeutic session, what I learned over time is one version of dad was he was a drunken old SOB and was abusive to my mom and me, and I hate his guts and I spit on his grave. The other one, well, he wasn't such a bad guy after all. Mm-hmm. You know, he came to my sports games. He came to the.
You seem to highlight the negatives, and
so where people get hung up is they feel, in a sense, forced to choose one story or the other, deny the other side. It works both ways. So some of the work in therapy is how you actually embrace both.
Yeah. Dad was actually both.
And I won't go into the details of this, but how you, it's not forever, but it's consciously bringing that both of these are true, and basically how our inner lives, our psyches have a way of, or fate sometimes have a way of finding a resolution to those opposites. It's called the tension of the opposites. And it takes a lot of patience to do that. It's not something you can say, well, I did it in therapy session. Good. I'm on my way. These things might take, who knows how long? Am I a week, a month, a year? Suddenly you'll be able to have a recognition of what combined version of dad is closer to your truth about them. So, if we're getting on the road with what therapy can be, it's not this way for a lot of people, but, the ghost, there are a couple really good books by James Sauls. One is Dispelling the Ghosts That Rule Our Lives is something like that. And that's so true. For so many people, we have that invisible script-writing ghost, our moms, our dads, usually one or the other or both, that seem to be leading us and guiding us, not always in directions we really want should be on.
You had a quote, and I'm going to misquote it, but a rock lost in the river is found in the river.
Right, right.
And it comes down to how you look for that, you know, what things are interfering with your line of sight.
Right.
What does that quote mean to you?
Well, this quote is actually a Zen koan, which is a used in training Zen priests, and it's a way of presenting puzzles to the mind. These are not puzzles to be solved. They're puzzles to be wrestled with. If you don't mind, I'll read just...
Please.
See, in writing this book, a particular Zen koan was present for me. The coin lost in the river is found in the river. The coin lost in the river is found in the river. And of course, it's utterly like, well, duh, of course. It's like saying, it's as though, of course, it's not true. Like, well, I found my keys where I left them last, and that's where I found them. It's not that at all. It reminded me of the many mysteries of my life. Who am I? To what extent did simple twists of fate shape the contours of my destiny? Over many months, I came to understand firsthand that the purpose of a koan is to tease the mind while pushing it beyond its limitations of reason and explanations. The coin lost in the river is found in the river. The meaning of life, if there is one, may be like a coin that is lost in clear river water, but due to the distortion and refraction of light, it may not be where we think it should be. And in searching the murky waters of life, it may be impossible to discern. Sometimes all we can do is fumble blindly in the dark. Like all koans, my story is incomplete and it has an uncertain ending. After writing the ups and downs, the joys and challenges of the chapters of my life, I've lost my fondness for certainty. It inhibits curiosity and dampens the capacity to hold the mystery of it all. If there's any meaning to be found in life, I believe it's in the searching, not in the finding. Sometimes I think that after all these years, I have found myself. Other times, I'm less sure. I do know one thing. I've always been a lucky boy, but I still don't know why. I'm more content that way, not knowing. What would life be anyway without its mysteries slipping through our fingers, like coins in a river, lost and found, again and again? So that was the way I end the book, and it seemed to me I was approaching writing the book that this issue of finding some grand resolution to the questions and mysteries of my own life didn't deserve to have rational conclusions and you know, tightly tied up bows at the end of the thing. In fact, this issue, as I just read, this issue, when we get down to identity and who are we, it has to contain an issue of mystery. The other forces that make, why in this life did I, why have I lived this life? Why have I had such enormously good luck? Why did I avoid what could have been a very tragic life, instead I got this one. So if that was the case, what was the purpose? Part of the purpose is actually to write this book. But I like for myself anyway, I was content with the idea of ending on a note of mystery, because I think the more we delve into the nature of who we are, into psyche, into the unconscious, the more questions we get rather than answers. And that to me is ultimately, for me personally, it's satisfying.
That's awesome. Stephen Rowley, The Lost Coin. Where can people get your book?
Well, you can get it on Amazon for the most part. Or it's on my website, which is StephenRowley108.com. There's a whole page there. Other sources you can get the book. You can't get it here locally for various reasons.
Eagle Harbor Books, reach out to me.
Amazon's probably the best and easiest place. This is some other bookstores over in Seattle, but the book's only been out since the end of the middle of September. So we're just beginning to get into bookstores. I'm not discouraged at all, but particularly since the feedback I've gotten from people through podcasts and other appearances, it's been worth it. Maybe a little bit like you've said about having this podcast. These can be expensive hobbies.
Well, thanks for putting the Bystander Podcast on your book tour.
Sure.
This time.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I wish you all the success in the world. Great book. Good story. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Bystander. Be kind.